Well, it's me again asking another question. I guess this is kind of a quickie. I read in your book about Jupiter intercepting a lot of the comets and meteors, et cetera, and that's one of the main advantages of the way God created the solar system, with Jupiter being where it is. But what are some of the other aspects that Jupiter, if any, you know, how can I phrase it? How do we benefit from Jupiter besides in those ways?
Okay, if Jupiter were even the tiniest bit closer to the sun, or if it were slightly more massive, it would disturb our orbit, and advanced life would not be possible on planet Earth. If it were slightly farther away or slightly less massive, it wouldn't protect us from taking too many hits from asteroids and comets. Because of the orbit and the mass of Jupiter, we're well protected from being hit by big asteroids and comets. But the only time that happens is when we either cross a spiral arm or we go right through the plane of the galaxy. As our sun orbits about the center of the galaxy, it actually moves up and down a bit. And so every 33 million years, it goes through the plane, and there you got a probability of getting a comet or an asteroid of a certain size striking the Earth. And that's actually necessary in order to compensate for the brightening of the sun, because it's critical that life be removed from the planet and replaced by new life that's more efficient in drawing greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. And what's unusual about the sun as it orbits about the center of the galaxy, it goes up and down by very little. And because it goes up and down by very little, we never get exposed to the deadly radiation from the black hole at the center of our galaxy. But it is the case that when we go through the plane, that disturbs the Oort cloud of comets and asteroids. And that's when you get a chance of a big enough collision to wipe out half or three-quarters of all the species of life on planet Earth. And that's actually a good thing, because if you leave life here on planet Earth too long, then the sun gets so bright that all life gets exterminated. By removing the life and replacing it with brand new life that's more efficient at drawing greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere, the temperature on the surface of the Earth remains constant for 3.8 billion years. Otherwise, the temperature would be jumping up by 50 to 100 degrees every half billion years. So wouldn't be a good thing. But Jupiter is ideally positioned. And incidentally, Jupiter by itself does not provide adequate protection. We also need Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And we need them orbiting in such a way with a certain mass distribution to give us adequate protection. And it's important that Jupiter be the most massive, Saturn the next, and then Uranus and Neptune considerably less massive. And having orbits where they kind of distribute their shielding of asteroid and comet collisions. So yeah, every few years you get to see a giant comet strike Jupiter, and it's always a spectacular scene. You can even see it in small telescopes, the blemish that you see on the face of Jupiter when it gets hit by one of those big comets. But far more frequently, it simply scatters the comets and asteroids away from the Earth. Go ahead.
When you answered Dave at the beginning, it reminded me of a recent trip to the old gold mining town of Julian, California. You had both talked when you answered Dave about the water that had been forced onto the Earth, and then also the massive amount of gold brought to Africa. There was a well there by a gold mine where the water, you could see down like 100 feet, and they used to, you know, get the water up here 100 years ago, and then it's gone way down. And with them saying that the government saying that the drought's not over despite the amount of rain and such, is there variations in that water that was forced on the Earth that might explain, or is that truly a drought that the water keeps going down and keeps going down? And then also, maybe where, if it's known where we got our gold from, since we know where Africa got their gold from.
Well, the Earth actually has gold that it was born with. But, yeah, the richest gold deposits are here because of asteroids. I mean, there are asteroids out there that are basically pure ore. The most common of those pure ore asteroids are ones that are stainless steel. In fact, about a quarter of all the asteroids in the main belt are stainless steel asteroids. And the greatest stainless steel is actually better than anything we manufacture here on Earth. And so, yeah, there are asteroids out there that are pure iron, nickel, and cobalt. And then there are other asteroids that are loaded with platinum and gold and silver and copper. In fact, NASA has their eyes on one asteroid that they valued at $50 quadrillion in terms of its ore deposits. And so they've actually argued that the cheapest way for us to get the metals we need is simply to grab one of those asteroids out in the asteroid belt, drag it back to Earth, and chop it up and sell it. So, and they're right. It's actually economically very feasible to do that. The technology currently exists to do exactly that, and it could dramatically lower the price of precious metals. So, who knows? I'm just hoping NASA doesn't have an accident. So, in fact, they've actually said, you know, the way to prevent an accident is to put it in lunar orbit rather than Earth orbit. So, but even a lunar orbit, you got to watch out for. So, your question was,
Just as far as it, then you know, looking.
Oh, the water. Yeah, what's happening with the water? Well, the ice age, the last ice age, actually got all the way down into parts of Southern California. I mean, all of the Sierras were covered with ice, and a lot of ice. I mean, when you visit Yosemite Valley, that valley is new. It didn't exist 40,000 years ago. It was carved out by the retreat of ice from the last ice age. And in many respects, we in California are still living off of the ice left over from the last ice age. I mean, what's remarkable is the only valley glacier in the 48 states, the lower 48, is in California. And, you know, it's situated just where Big Pine, California is. So it's actually in Southern California. And yet you've got a big valley glacier there. And that glacier is left over from the last ice age. And the melting of glaciers left over from the last ice age is basically what allows us to grow so much food in the San Joaquin Valley. But we've been draining that ice, and so it's rapidly disappearing. And what's remarkable is that the ice left over from the last ice age has lasted as long as it has. It's been 14,000 years since the last major retreat from the last ice age. So we've had a warm interglacial for 14,000 years. And it's the only interglacial where the ice has actually been melting for the entire time. And that's because the last ice age was the most severe ice age in the entire ice age cycle. So literally all over the world, we're benefiting from the melting of ice left over from the last ice age. But when that ice is gone, that will also be the end of large-scale agriculture. I mean, we're able to feed 7 billion people today because we got water, but most of that water comes from melting ice left over from the last ice age. And yeah, there are people concerned that we're going to run out. And yeah, with an ice age cycle, it's inevitable you're going to run out, unless we have another ice age, in which case the ice will be replaced. And so I think that explains what's going on, say, in Julian, is, yeah, 200 years ago, there was a lot more groundwater than there is right now. And the rainfall in California has been steadily declining. So, yeah, it explains why it's getting drier and drier. And the global warming models predict that California, Southern California, will get drier, whereas Northern California and Oregon will get wetter.
Hi, Dr. Ross. I'm working in a context where we rely routinely on the continuity of genetics across different species, and then also we tend to talk about the continuity of brain structure across different species, and we talk about the development of the neocortex in non-human primates, et cetera, Neanderthals. And I've read Francis Collins' book, Biologos, and I hear these terms, creation, evolution, mm-hmm. microevolution, all these things thrown around. And I just wondered if you could comment on how you understand Biologos and your understanding of how we got here. And I know that's a hard question, so however you'd like to answer it.
Well, it's a pertinent question because we've been in a 9.5-year relationship with Biologos. We've been having closed-door meetings as well as public meetings. And next month, we're releasing a book. It's a two-views book, Reasons to Believe in Biologos, Contrasting Their Different Models. It's not so much a debate book as a position book. The debate books will come later. So, yeah, it took me a while to figure out the difference, for example, between evolutionary creationism and theistic evolution. There is a difference. Most theistic evolutionists will deny all the Old Testament and New Testament miracles, whereas I notice the Biologos evolutionary creationists, they accept all the New Testament miracles, but they have a difficult time accepting the Old Testament miracles. Or to put it another way, they accept all the miracles that can't be scientifically tested. So changing water into wine, that's immune to scientific testing. They're okay with that, virgin birth, etc. But a lot of the Old Testament miraculous claims are things that can be tested. And so they're basically saying, we don't think those are real miracles, whereas we do. That's the main difference between the two of us. The other big difference, and I found this out just literally a month ago, where I was doing a public forum with Deborah Harzma, the president of Biologos. And so I asked her, well, I know some of your people are accommodationists theologically. Are you all? And she says, yeah, we all are. And the difference there is accommodationism is the belief, I mean, they will claim that they believe the Bible is inspired and inerrant, but the way they define that is they say when the Holy Spirit speaks on his own, it's inspired and inerrant. But they believe that the Holy Spirit partners with a human author and doesn't bother to correct the errors of the human author. And so they anticipate that the human authors will parrot the scientific errors of their contemporaries. And so it's a lot like the higher criticism of the early 19th century. In fact, I've written in my book, Navigating Genesis, that it's deja vu. It's the higher criticism theology coming back. Maybe not in as extreme a form, but it's got a lot of the same characteristics. So this book coming out next month should make it clear. And the book actually shows you where we agree. I mean, every chapter, it's where we agree and where we disagree. And we discuss cosmology, geophysics, human origins, origin of life, the history of life, the higher animals. So, for example, we believe that the birds and mammals are exceptional compared to all other life, but that humans are exceptional compared to the birds and mammals, whereas they have a variety of views on that. That's something else that's difficult. They have a broad spectrum of theological and scientific positions, whereas we at Reasons to Believe, we have our differences, but it's a much narrower range of differences than what they express. So, for example, I was surprised to discover that there are about 50-50 physicalists and dualists in the Biologos camp. I first thought they were all dualists, but now I've found that half of them are physicalists.
Okay, here we have a write-in question. After the Lord's Prayer that everybody is quite familiar with, starting Matthew 6, 14 and 15, Jesus, after the Lord's Prayer, continues to say, for if you forgive other people when they sin against you, your Heavenly Father will also forgive you. And then in 15 it says, but if you do not forgive men against their sins, your Father will not forgive your sins. So the question is, sometimes it takes months to forgive people. I know people that went through their whole lifetime with not forgiving people, become very bitter people. So is these two verses saying then that somebody's salvation could possibly be in jeopardy if they do not forgive other people or take too long to forgive other people?
Well, the principle of that passage is that, if you don't forgive others, God won't forgive you. And the whole point is the problem with that position is you're basically saying some other human being offended me more than I've offended the God that created me. And so, becoming a Christian is recognizing the magnitude of what God the Son has done on our behalf, and that we've offended him greater than any human being has ever offended another human being. And we have to recognize, the depth of our rebellion against God. And so, to say that I've been offended more than God's been offended, that's blasphemous. Now, does that mean I'm responsible to forgive everybody that has offended me? I mean, there are probably people I'm not even aware that I haven't forgiven. And what I tell people, in fact, I did a debate of an atheist at Iowa State University. And we had a private two-hour meeting after the debate was over. And he said, I've debated a lot of Christians. And he named one Christian. And he says, I'll never forgive that Christian until the day I die. And I says, well, if you will not forgive that individual, then Christ is not going to be able to forgive you. And he says, well, there's no way I can forgive that person the way he treated me in the debate. And I said, well, would you be willing to have God give you the ability to forgive? And he said, yeah, I can't forgive, but if God can actually help me to forgive, and if he's willing to give me time to reach that point, I'm okay with that. And that's basically, I think, how you interpret Matthew 7, is that it's one thing where you say, I'll never forgive that person to the day I die, no matter what, as opposed to saying, it's not my heart to forgive that person right now. I don't have the capacity. I've been wounded to such a great degree, but I'm willing to work on it. If you're willing to work on it, God's okay with that. And I don't think God expects you to remember everybody that you've got a grudge against. Because after all, we've got a lot of low-level grudges. So not only against people, but maybe even against some of the pets that we have in our home. And or the cockroaches that invade our home. So, what the Holy Spirit's really looking for, are you willing to work on it? And if you say, no, I'm not willing to work on it, that's a problem. Go ahead.
Okay. Recently, well, for a while now, hear a lot about Russia in the news and the Middle East, and these are hot spots, and there's others, but it always reminds me of Battle of Gog and Magog. And I know you probably don't have a slide of this one, but I do remember you had a slide at one point that had kind of the major players, like from Ezekiel 38 and 39, like Put and Cush and Beth Togarmah and all these things that Persia. And I was wondering, as I keep hearing these in the news, I keep thinking, well, I know it was about, over 2,500 years ago that, this account or this prophecy took place. But as you see it, and I always think, gosh, if we see it in our lifetime, then we have something to tell our fellow humans, basically, like, look how reliable the Bible is. And I keep thinking, well, we probably shouldn't be distracted by some of that. But God did give us clues, and he did let us know something about it, so it's okay to think about. So as I was sitting here thinking, gosh, I remember a slide you had probably 35 years ago, maybe 30 years ago in the church.
Closer to 40.
Is it? Wow, time goes by fast. So have you looked into that again? I mean, does it make you curious? Do you have any new thoughts? Are we anywhere near Battle of Gog and Magog? I mean, we'll know it when we see it, I guess, maybe, but...
Yeah, well, you're probably aware that, there was one lady in our class that actually edited the entire series that I taught in the Book of Revelation. Oh, yeah. If you weren't around, that was like 30, 40 years ago. And it was a 7-year, 9-month long class. So they've been referring to it here in the church as a 7-year tribulation. So, and it took that long because I told the church, if you want me to teach on Revelation, you have to understand that the book of Revelation is a capstone to all the Old Testament prophetic books, and we're going to have to study more than 1/3 of the entire Bible. It's going to take a while. So in that class, we studied all of Daniel, all of Zechariah, a really big chunk of Ezekiel, Isaiah, and Jeremiah, and several other texts, even Deuteronomy is included in what you see in the book of Revelation. The entire course has now been edited and put on MP3s. It's available from paradoxes.org. And people have asked me, hey, it's been 30, 40 years. Would you change anything? Yeah, I'd make minor changes, but only minor changes. I don't see any reason to change anything that I've put in that point right there. And those of you that are with us will remember that I covered different what I thought were valid interpretations. So it wasn't just one interpretation. We covered the range of interpretations. But you are right about Ezekiel. And what I taught in that class is the place names you see in the Bible about the major players and the end times events, they're referring to people rather than to lands. And the people move. And so the people of Magog are not in the same position as they were 4,000 years ago. And so you actually see that in the Table of Nations, where it talks about the movements of these different nations. And so I think the correct interpretation is, where are they living right now? So, but in terms of being a piece of evidence for the inspiration and inerrancy of the Bible, I think a good place to go is Ezekiel 32 through 40, because those are the passages that predict that Israel as a nation will be reborn and describes in detail what will happen to that reborn nation. And many of those prophecies have been fulfilled in the last 75 years. And so that means you got hindsight. I mean, these passages were written 2,500 years ago, 2,600 years ago, and they were fulfilled in the lifetime of those of us who are older. And, you know, even some of those prophecies were literally fulfilled in the last 10 to 20 years. So I like taking people who are not yet convinced the Bible's word of God and saying, look at what it says about Israel, and all this came true. So, in fact, what's really interesting is it says in Ezekiel 32 and 33 that God would perform miracles for the Israelis in the newborn nation of Israel, like he did in the days of King David. But he says the Jews living in the reborn state of Israel will not give him the credit. But it says the Gentiles will. And that's exactly what's been happening. The Gentile nations are saying, this is the fingerprint of God. But the Jews in Israel are saying, we did it. So, but also says a time will come when the Jews in Israel will give God the credit, just not now. Oh, and there's also a thing you can get from us. It's a 3-part message on Israel, a modern-day miracle. So that's available as well.
Hi, Dr. Ross. I just had a question, and it is stating that Stephen Hawking believes that Gödel's incompleteness theorem makes the search for a theory of everything impossible. I don't know much about the incompleteness theorem. I was hoping you might be able to
Sure. Hawking is basically right. Because of the Gödel's incompleteness theorem, scientists will never get a theory of everything. And that's interesting because Stephen Hawking says that's my lifelong goal, is to achieve a theory of everything. But yeah, if you read all of his papers, in one of those papers he says that a theory of everything is impossible. And one reason why a theory, and what Hawking means by a theory of everything, would be a theory that unifies with complete understanding of 4 fundamental forces of physics: gravity, the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, and the electromagnetic force. and we now have a complete understanding of the unification of the electromagnetic force and the weak nuclear force. And we've got a partial understanding of how the strong nuclear force is united. We have no understanding of how gravity fits into it. But yeah, a lot of theoretical physicists said that's our goal. But practically speaking, you will not get a complete understanding of how the four forces of physics unify until we have a particle accelerator that extends from the Earth to the farthest galaxy in the universe. And a number of physicists have joked that will not be funded until Democrats control all branches of the government.
Hugh, just tagging on that, isn't gravity pretty much also just one of the big unknowns of the universe? I mean, we have theories about how gravity works, but in reality, nobody really knows. Is that correct? Or is that something new?
Okay. Well, we got a good understanding of the force of gravity and the theory of gravity. What we lack is an understanding of how gravity unites with a strong electroweak force when the universe is only 10 to the minus 43 seconds old. And that would require knowledge of what happens when the universe has an extremely tiny volume and an extremely high temperature and extremely high energy density. And, you know, really to gain an understanding of that requires building a particle accelerator that duplicates those energy conditions. But that's beyond the capability of any conceivable technology. A simpler way to express Gödel's incompleteness theorem is that in order to have a complete understanding of a system, you have to be able to get outside of the system so you can observe everything about the system. And that's impossible for the universe because we're constrained by the space-time dimensions of the universe. And so since we're inside the universe and can never get outside of it, it's impossible for us to have a complete understanding of the universe. Now, the good news about that is it means astronomers will never be laid off from the fact that we've learned everything about the universe. There will always be more to learn and discover.
When I see you on YouTube debating, you're always very cool, cordial, and respectful. What do you, and your opponents aren't, what do you do to get ready for a debate?
Well, in terms of getting ready for a debate, I just try to know my subject really well. And because what I notice is frequently my debate partners run out of content. And when they run out of content is when they get angry. So I make sure I never run out of content. In fact, in the debates I've done, I'm lucky if I get through 5% of the content I've prepared for the debate. But I think that really helps me stay calm, just realizing I've always got more I can add to strengthen my position. But that's also frustrating. Sometimes I walk away from the debate and say, you know, I never got to present my strongest points. That happens. So it also helps that I'm on the autistic spectrum, which means I can't read the emotional state. I don't even know they're angry at me. So that helps a lot. However, one thing I'll say about being on the autistic spectrum, it's not that you have no emotions and can't read emotions. It just takes a lot longer than normal people. And so 2 hours after the debate, everything finally falls on me. And that's when I get highly disturbed. But then the debate's over. So.
And Dr. Ross, I recently watched a video about the monarch butterflies being able to fly from Canada down to Mexico. They've never been there before. Nobody knows how they know to navigate. I'm just wondering if that's an example of something where they get clued into another realm, another world, a spirit world. And if you've got any books on that sort of subject?
I don't have any books on it, but there was a paper published literally just 6 weeks ago where scientists claim they discovered how the monarch butterfly pulls that off. And, you know, other species like birds can do that because they got the equivalent of a magnet in their brain, and it basically guides them through the magnetic field of the Earth. Turtles do it as well. But a butterfly is really tiny. It can't be transporting a bar magnet anywhere on its body. It would be just too big. But what this paper pointed out is the monarch butterfly does that with a single molecule. One molecule basically gives it a magnetic navigation system.
Okay, so it's got a compass, but how does it know which direction to go?
Well, what's built into the genome of birds and turtles and monarch butterflies is a code that tells them what angle of the magnetic field they need to home in on. So it's actually built in right to their DNA.
Who built that in?
Pardon me?
Who built that in?
Yeah, who built that in, exactly. So yeah, that was coded in advance. So, but yeah, I mean, what mystified scientists literally for decades is where is this compass in monarch butterfly, and they finally found the compass. It's just a single molecule. But yeah, in terms of the guidance system, that's coded into the DNA.
Pigeons and doves are the other ones that have that ability to fly at night with no light.
Right, yeah.
Thank you. Okay, I have two questions. I got to figure out which one's more important to me to get an answer to, because I know this is my last question. Okay, there's one planet in the solar system that revolves the opposite way the other ones do. Why is that the case?
All the planets actually revolve around the sun in the same direction. But Venus rotates in the opposite direction. And the belief is what happened to Venus, it flipped over. And so when its rotation axis completely flipped over, that caused it to rotate in the opposite direction that it revolves. And incidentally, that happens to all planets that lack a gigantic moon. I mean, the reason why the Earth doesn't do that is that you've got a small planet orbited by a really big single moon. And it's that high ratio of mass between the Earth's moon and the Earth's, Earth's mass that stabilizes the tilt of the rotation axis. Our rotation axis tilt only varies by 2 degrees. Whereas if you look at Mars, it varies by 65 degrees. If you want to know why the polar caps on Mars are as tiny as they are, given how far away it is from the sun, it's because the polar axis, the rotation axis of Mars does this. And so where it gets the polar cap is from comets. As I told you before, comets are 85% frozen water. So if comets land at the north or south pole of Mars, it's permanently cold enough there that that ice will never evaporate, whereas ice near the equator will evaporate. But what happens is you get the buildup of ice at the north and south pole of Mars, then the rotation axis tilts over. And when that happens, it gets exposed to enough sunlight and sun heat that it melts the ice. And so a new polar cap has to form. So that's why you don't get a lot of ice on Mars. And incidentally, all the planets do that. In fact, I think it's Uranus, where the rotation axis actually points right towards the sun.
My question was about the planets turning around. Did you answer that question?
Oh, no. All the planets go around the sun in the same direction.
Now, they do rotate on their axis in a certain direction. But I thought there was one planet that goes the other direction.
Well, the problem with Venus is its rotation period is longer than its revolutionary period. Okay. So that explains that phenomena. I mean, that's what happens. Both Mercury and Venus are experiencing tidal locking, which means that you're going to have very long days. And so you've got Mercury with a day almost as long as the revolutionary period. With Venus, the day is actually longer than its revolutionary period.
Okay.
but all the other planets rotate fast. And incidentally, Earth is just far enough away to avoid that phenomenon. As it is, our rotation period has slowed down by a factor of 6 over the history of life. So it wasn't always 24 hours a day. There was a time when it was 4 hours a day. And that's another reason why God waits so long to put animals on the face of the earth. Got to wait for the spin to go down. But, you know, meanwhile, God packs the earth with lots of microbes, and you literally need 3 billion years of bacterial transformation of the earth before animals and plants are even possible. So, yeah, tonight we might thank God for 3 billion years of bacterial proliferation on the face of the earth.
Real quick, you mentioned Israel, a modern-day miracle. Is that yours, or is that a different author of the video?
Oh, it's mine.
Okay, sorry, okay.
And it's audio. We don't have it as video.
Audio, okay. And then you were speaking with my question before and maybe somebody else's, global warming. And some people would point out the scientists that were hiding some of the papers and such that were for global warming. So, are you really sold on that? And then where would we find out more about that side? Do you also have something written up on pro side of global warming?
Yeah, I mean, one of the books we gave away tonight, Improbable Planet, you got a very long chapter 15, which addresses global warming and climate stability. And let me actually bring up a slide for you here that might help you understand this. Here we go. Okay, this shows you the ice age cycle for the last 400,000 years. And what you notice here is this is a temperature scale. And so you see that, for about 90,000 years, you got 20% of the planet covered with ice. And then the planet suddenly warms, and most of that ice melts away to where you only have 10%. But what's typical is that the temperature rises sharply, hits a maximum, then drops suddenly back into another ice age. And as you move forward, we got more detail on that temperature. And so this is what the last ice age looks like. But what you reveal here is you have extreme climate instability. This is the global mean temperature. It's literally jumping up and down by 24 degrees Fahrenheit over time scales of just a century or two. And that explains why early humans were not able to launch large-scale agriculture. The climate was way too unstable to permit that possibility. In fact, we do have evidence that humans living 35,000 years ago were engaged in sophisticated farming. They were planting grains. They were harvesting the grains, roasting the grains, grinding the grains, and making bakery products. But it was all on a very small scale. At such a small scale that the human population and technology was not able to advance. What is unusual about the last 9,000 years is we've had extreme climate stability. Now, what's driving the up and down temperature changes are 7 different cycles in the orbit of the Earth about the Sun. What's unique about the last 9,000 years, it's the only time it's happened in the entire Ice Age cycle, is that 7 of those cycles all came into sync to give us this period of extreme climate stability. And as an astronomer, I can tell you, it can't be sustained. It will go out of sync. It's bound to happen, and it's bound to happen relatively quickly. And when it does, we'll rapidly drop into an ice age. In fact, I've read a couple of research papers which says we may already be seeing the beginnings of the onset of the next ice age. And you say, how do you explain that in view of the fact that everybody's worried about global warming? Well, the enigma of global warming is it will actually drive the onset of an ice age cycle. And the best theory explaining that says that as the planet warms, you melt the polar ice cap. And when you melt the polar ice cap, more water is evaporated off of the Arctic Ocean, which results in more snow falling on Canada and Siberia. Now, as a Canadian, I can tell you, you can warm all of Canada by 10 degrees, and it'll still be a frozen wasteland, because, you know, warming it from 50 below to 40 below, you still got ice. And the problem is that if you melt the polar ice cap, it will more than double the amount of snowfall falling on Canada and Siberia. And that's enough to have thousands of feet of ice accumulate over Canada and Siberia, then for that ice to begin to move southward. So, yeah, we're not far off for an ice age. The first sign of the onset of another ice age is when you see the buildup of snow and ice in western Siberia, followed by the buildup of snow and ice in Labrador. We have no evidence that it's building up in Labrador, but there is some evidence that it's building up in western Siberia. And just in my lifetime, half of the polar ice cap has melted away. So, yeah, it wouldn't be difficult to foresee in the next 100 years all of it melting away. And if that were to happen, yeah, we're going to be quickly moving into an ice age. So,
Hugh, the part he was talking about, the fudging the data, I have a question about that. The scientists that have been fudging the data is we have this paradox where we know there's more carbon in the atmosphere now than there was, say, 100 years ago, $200, 300 years ago, and yet the temperature has not increased. And that's where the scientists have been lying. And they can't explain that paradox. How can we have so much more carbon in the air now that we
there
do
is a good
100,
explanation.
200 years, but the temperature has not gone up proportional to carbon?
Right, okay. Yeah, carbon dioxide is now above 400 parts per million in the atmosphere. And to put that in context, before the Industrial Revolution, it was 260 parts. So it's gone way up, and it is a powerful greenhouse gas. And yeah, if you look at the ice age cycle, the last 2.5 million years, there's been a direct correlation between the abundance of carbon dioxide and the global mean temperature. What has been newly discovered, however, there's a time delay. And now they're trying to measure what the time delay is. So, but it's at least several decades. Between the warming you get from pumping carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and when the carbon dioxide actually goes into the atmosphere. And so there's a lot of climatologists trying to determine what exactly is that time delay. But yeah, there have been papers published saying the planet's going to get a lot warmer because the carbon dioxide is already there and it's not going to go down, and therefore we're going to actually see the temperature go up even if we put no more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere because of the time delay. But yeah, we don't have good data on what that time delay is. Neither do we have good data on the percentage of the global warming being attributable to human causes. We know it's at least 20%. It could be as high as 80%. And when you've got data that runs between 20 and 80%, that gives you lots of fuel for a political debate. I mean, because you're going to have people saying it's only 20, you're going to have people saying it's 80, and people in between. Now, what I wrote about in my book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, is that there are things that we can do to stabilize the climate and cool a global mean temperature that will boost the economy of all the nations of the world. And if we pursue those solutions, we take the politics out. Everybody's going to vote for a solution that puts more money in their pocket and makes for a healthier population. And so I give several examples that are literally drawn from the oldest book of the Bible on what we could do. And basically the message that you see in the book of Job, pay attention to the precipitation. So when it tells us to manage the planet for the benefit of all life, you've got an entire chapter and a half that basically says we need to stabilize the precipitation. And notice all the political debate today is about stabilizing the temperature. We'd be far better off to focus on stabilizing the precipitation. And just to give you an extreme example, in the past 2,000 years, we've made the Sahara Desert 10 times bigger than what it was. It's now bigger than the continent of Australia. But at one time, it was like the size of, like the size of France. And so we've turned it from the size of France into the size of Australia just in 2,000 years. How long would it take to reverse it? Less than 30 years. So we could literally bring the Sahara Desert back to the way it was 2,000 years ago. And if you read Roman history, they got most of their grain from what is now the Sahara Desert. The Sahara Desert fed the Roman Empire. Now it feeds nobody. But what if we could transform it to where it now became a rich supply of grain that would provide income for all those African nations? It would feed people. It'd be a great economic boost to the world, and it would absorb huge quantities of greenhouse gases. So to me, that's one of the no-brainers we ought to pursue. And I think if you're a Democrat, you'll vote for it. If you're a Republican, you'll vote for it.
Real quick, yes or no, then it sounds it's technologically, it's much easier to cool the planet than it is to warm it, correct?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
There's a verse in Joshua that speaks about the sun standing still.
Right.
Could you comment on that?
Yeah, we've got a paper on that in our website that we make available for free. And if you want a more in-depth discussion, we actually have a DVD on Joshua's long day. And I've discussed this with a number of Hebrew scholars, and what they tell me is, you know, Hebrew is not like Greek. It's a long ways away from the English language in terms of its vocabulary and grammar. And when you look at Joshua 10, it's actually communicating either an extended period of darkness or the valley of Ajalon or an extended period of light. It's a mistake to read the text as God stopping the earth's rotation or adjusting the other bodies in the solar system. It's not saying that at all. It's basically saying God imposed about a 24-hour period of darkness or the valley of Ajalon or a 24-hour period of light. And scholars like Walt Kaiser told me that based on the Hebrew, it's much more likely that it's a period of extended darkness. Most English translations have it as more light, but he says, no, it's actually far more likely it's an extended period of darkness. And my wife and I actually visited the Valley of Ajalon in 1980. It's in the Negev Desert. It's really hot there. And also, it's a small valley ringed by hills. So you don't have to make it dark or light on a very big area. And, I kind of agree with Walt Kaiser that likely Joshua needed something to cool his troops. And so the darkness would have brought the temperature way down. And just a month ago, I was in Houston when they told me to take cover because there was an imminent tornado that was going to run through Houston. I got to see the funnel, but it never touched the ground. However, the sky got incredibly dark. It was so dark, it looked like it was night, and yet it was 1 p.m. in the day. And so there are meteorological phenomena that can make it really dark. And also, the temperature dropped. You actually got to feel the temperature drop by 20 degrees in a matter of minutes. So, however, that kind of a meteorological phenomena is common in Dallas and Houston and Kansas. It's Tornado Alley. But the Negev is not Tornado Alley. And so the idea that you had that kind of phenomena happening there, I can see why people call it a miracle. Because, those kinds of meteorological events just aren't that common in that area. But also the fact that we're looking at a small valley, not a big region, I can see that being something that God would do within the laws of physics rather than outside the laws of physics. And what I discuss in the DVD is actually a much more dramatic miracle is what you see recorded in Isaiah 38. Where you got the sundial of Hezekiah going back 40 minutes. And the text tells us that the sundial in downtown Babylon also went back 40 minutes. So you got two sundials, one in Jerusalem and one in Babylon, that both went back 40 minutes at the same time. And the text tells us in Isaiah that this so surprised the prophets of Marduk in Babylon, they sent a delegation to Jerusalem to investigate the miracle, which tells you something about the reputation of the God of the Jews to the nations around them. It's like, here are the prophets of the temple of Marduk saying, this is not our God. This has got to be the real God, the one that the Jews worship in Jerusalem. We better go to Jerusalem and see what's going on. And they inquired of the miracle. Now, the reason why I think this is a more outstanding miracle, it happened over 600 miles rather than just a small valley. And it'd be hard for me to imagine a meteorological event which would actually cause the shadow to go back that much in both of those locations, unless you got some meteorological event happening there, no one here, nothing in between. Most Bible scholars think that the miracle of the sundial is God shining his Shekinah glory, because you don't need darkness, you need extra light to make it work. And so they would see that as a miracle outside of space and time, where he shone his light in those two locations and made the sundial go back. So I actually see that in the text, because Hezekiah says, well, it's one thing for it to go forward. That would be an easy miracle. Making it go backward would be more challenging. And God is saying, hey, challenging miracles aren't a problem for me.
Right now, it seems as if naturalism is the most accepted metaphysics in academia. But my question is, assuming that Christianity wouldn't be true, so we'll take Christianity off the table and its associated metaphysics, would naturalism be the runner-up? Is it the most likely? Is it the next most likely explanation for the world? Or do you think that there are... So I guess my question is, to phrase it better, how would you order the most likely metaphysics from, you know, we can put Christianity as number one, but what would your 2, 3, 4 be?
Well, I think a lot depends on what timing you're looking at in terms of the science. What I notice is that the naturalists predominantly come from the life sciences and the social sciences. It's rare to find a real naturalist in the physical sciences. And that's because typically the physical scientists study not just the present era, but also deep time. And whereas most people in the life sciences and social sciences are doing research in the human era. And according to the Bible, naturalism is what you expect in the human era. For 6 days God creates, on the seventh day he stops creating. And so methodological naturalism is exactly what the Bible teaches you should expect and you should use for your scientific investigation if you're talking any time after the creation of Eve, because that's when God stops his work of creation. And so according to the Bible, it's strictly natural process in terms of the sciences, especially the life sciences, once you get past God creating Adam and Eve. But the 6 days of creation, that's when God is actively intervening. And so if you're looking before the human era, you would anticipate it would be a combination of natural process and supernatural intervention. But even there, you're going to see a lot of natural process. So for example, as an astronomer, natural process is all I need to understand how stars form and how galaxies form. But if I want to understand why the solar system is so extraordinarily unique compared to all other planetary systems, then I'm tempted to say it's because God designed it that way, or he's let everything else run by natural process, but this is a special place he designed. And we're told that in Proverbs and Psalms and Job, that the more we study the record of nature, the more evidence we'll see for the supernatural handiwork of God. But that means the scientist has to be willing to look. So, you know, if you've got a physicist saying, I'm only going to look for natural causation, I'm going to ignore the supernatural, then he will be selective. He's basically going to say, I'm not going to study Big Bang cosmology. I'm not going to study why our galaxy is so different from other galaxies. I'm going to do other research. And so in that sense, you can be a contented naturalist, but it does mean you've got to constrain the range of your scientific investigation. And let me just say a word in favor of the Sabbath. God ordained the Sabbath to ensure that we have regular time to focus on the most important issues of life. And a critique I have of a lot of my scientist colleagues, they don't take time to deal with the most important issues of life. I'll give you an example. A few years ago, I debated Peter Ward, and I was an atheist versus a Christian. But after the debate was over, he said, you know, for the last 40 years, I've called myself an atheist. Actually, the truth is, I've never really thought about whether or not there's a God. I never thought about death or what's going to happen to me after I die. Maybe I need to start thinking about those questions. And he says, honestly, I've been distracted by my science. And it was obvious in his talk. He's extremely passionate about the science he's doing. And he's getting great enjoyment out of his scientific research. And I've read his books. His books are really enjoyable to read because you can tell this guy is really having fun doing his science and trying to figure things out. But he told me privately, he says, you know, my scientific research is like a video game. I'm so distracted. And it's totally captivating. It's all-consuming. And yeah, I've not taken the time to think about the important issues of life. So.
Who was that?
Peter Ward.
Peter what?
Peter Ward. He's one of the co-authors of the book Rare Earth.
Oh, yeah.
That's an interesting book because it was written by an atheist paleontologist, Peter Ward, and an agnostic astronomer, Don Brownlee. And but we interviewed Don Brownlee, and he said, well, you know, maybe I'm not an agnostic. Maybe I'm a deist. But he says, I'm definitely not a theist. So.
Would you consider Improbable Planet as being Rare Earth Volume 2?
Yeah, I'd say Improbable Planet is the sequel to Rare Earth. And
what year was Rare Earth? It was quite a while. It was in the 80s or
no, the Rare 90s. Earth was published about 16, 17 years ago.
Yeah. So a lot of new discovery since then.
Lots been discovered since then. And yeah, what you get in Rare Earth is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, basically they talked about paleontology and plate tectonics and a little bit about the solar system, and that's about it. It never got into the universe or the galaxy or, for that matter, the origin of life or the history of life.
I'm going to ask you to close in prayer in just one moment, just to remind people we still have some treats over here. And Colleen, thank you for manning the book table. If you get the books here, you get a discount. They're less than any other place. And so Colleen can help you in selecting books. If you'd like to hear Ross, he, as we said already, he teaches Sunday morning at 11 o'clock across the parking lot, the Paradox class. And also on June 11th, he'll actually be in the pulpit teaching at the 10:30 and 11 o'clock service on June 11th. And then, of course, you can always find Hugh at Reasons to Believe, reasons.org, and also past recordings. If you miss a Sunday morning, we have recordings that we put at paradoxes.org. If you could close us in prayer, Hugh.
I'll be happy to do that. And, yes, the endurable treats are over there, and the durable treats are over there. Okay. Yeah, all right. Father in heaven, we do thank you for this time we've had together. And Lord, I pray that you continue to motivate us to ask questions and to think through the most important issues of life. And Lord, we're grateful too for the privilege of living in the 21st century when so much is being discovered. And Father, I pray that we wouldn't be totally captivated by the discoveries, as exciting and as fun as they are, but really think about the implications and the meaning and the significance and the purpose that lies behind them. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you. Sure.